From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, our Informed Voter series explores truth, fiction, and context in Wisconsin political ads.
If we say, you know, here are the facts in this case and they conflict with what's in an ad, there's nothing that requires a candidate to acknowledge that.
Later, we explore the relationship between the poverty rate in Milwaukee and in the rest of the state.
We'll travel to one of these sites people can visit during this weekend's Doors Open Milwaukee.
Plus, percussionist John Mueller talks about his collaboration with choreographer Dawn Springer and how they meld their unique talents for a singular performance.
It's gotten to the point now with me where I don't think so much about dance as this external or separate thing, but that movement and sound really are sort of part of the same world.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. The latest Marquette University Law School poll shows challenger Tony Evers holding a 5-point lead in his effort to unseat incumbent Scott Walker in the race for Wisconsin governor. That's an improvement for the Democrats since the last poll, which showed the candidates in a neck-and-neck race.
Election day is still more than 6 weeks away, and so one thing is almost assured: the war of television ads will continue to heat up in the coming days. And that's where we start our Informed Voter segment today. WUWM and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel are collaborating to answer questions texted to us from potential Wisconsin voters. Journal Sentinel Capital Bureau reporter Molly Beck joins us on the line from Madison. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked about our Informed Voter project a couple of weeks ago on Lake Effect, and we've been gathering questions texted in from listeners and readers since then and dividing them roughly into subject areas. For today's installment, we've gotten a bunch of questions about campaign ads, many of them along the lines of this one.
This is Beatrice in Washington County. Where can I find out if the claims that candidates make against their opponents in their ads are accurate?
I would imagine this is something you probably hear quite a bit in covering state politics.
Yeah, that's true. And the answer is, sadly, you either have to do a lot of research yourself, or you have to know, obviously, I'm going to make a pitch that you should come to the Journal Sentinel website and look at our many PolitiFacts that our PolitiFact team does on these ads. And also reporters like Patrick Marley in the Capitol and myself, we do a number of stories whenever there's an ad out. And if there's something that's being, you know, mischaracterized or there's more context that we feel that potential voters need to know, we will write those stories. And so really it's just a matter of, you know, relying on your local media. From my perspective, I think that's the best source of, you know, understanding the whole story when you see these ads.
Well, and one of the other things that this speaks to is that campaign ads are really not about nuance here. There are probably a lot of ads that might have a grain of truth and a grain of falsehood.
Right. There always has to be a grain of truth, or else the people that are making the ads can get in trouble and the ads will have to be taken off the air. But, for example, there's an ad running right now from Governor Walker's campaign, and it is against his opponent, State Superintendent Tony Evers. And there have been a lot of ads about whether or not Tony Evers should have revoked the teacher's license of a teacher in Middleton who was caught looking at pornography at school.
A teacher watched hardcore pornography in his classroom, showed obscene images to female co-workers, commented about the chest sizes of middle school girls, suggested one struggling student...
This is a pretty graphic ad, and it's getting a lot of attention because of what's in it. And the context to that is that while it's not completely made up, it is an accusation that somebody made against this teacher that could not be substantiated. But that's not in the ad. It makes it sound like this happened, and there's no question that this happened when there is a question.
The challenging part here is understanding the context to the story, and that's typically not the point of a political ad.
Right. I mean, political ad needs to be short, and it needs to make a point. It needs to be memorable. And this ad is obviously memorable because there's a lot of people talking about it. And we've done a couple stories on on what's in the ad and what's right about the ad and what needs more context or what is misleading, if anything's misleading. But that's, the ad's job is not to be an article like in the newspaper. It's supposed to just make a quick emotional tug, you know, make an emotional appeal to the viewer.
Well, and so briefly, what have you been able to uncover in terms of Tony Evers' position when it came to either taking away this teacher's teaching license or restoring it?
Yeah, so it's an interesting issue that I'm sure you'll hear about this until Election Day. This case was very controversial in Middleton at the time. It happened about a decade ago. And Tony Evers said that, and said, continues to say that he could not revoke the license of that teacher because students never saw the material that the teacher was looking at. And at the time of the incident when the teacher was looking at this pornography, state law said that you can revoke a teacher's license if, you know, students were harmed or affected in some way by this material. And no students ever saw the material, so he said, under law, I can't revoke this license, but he did object to the behavior. And then right after that, lawmakers, or actually it was right before he decided to not revoke the license, they changed the state law so Evers could revoke the license even if there's no students that were affected by it.
And that leads to another back and forth because there is, I believe, a Tony Evers commercial in which he makes the claim that he got the law changed.
The truth. Tony Evers would never put our children at risk. When the law stopped Tony Evers from revoking a teacher's license for viewing pornography, Tony worked with lawmakers from both parties to change the law so offenders could be kicked out of the classroom.
Right. It does imply that he was the one out there leading the effort to change the law, and that is not the case as far as I can gather. I wasn't actually working in the state at the time, so I don't remember, but what I found from, VPI documents and emails and talking to lawmakers who were involved in it and just looking at the legislative documents, it looks like that effort was led by a group of Republican lawmakers. But Tony Evers did work with them on changing the law, and he did support the law change. But if there's a claim being made that he was the one leading it, I don't believe that's true.
So the other issue that's had some back and forth, especially on television commercials, is healthcare. And who would require that insurance companies cover people with pre-existing conditions?
For 8 years, Scott Walker has worked to sabotage the Affordable Care Act and undermine its protections for the 2.4 million people in Wisconsin with a pre-existing condition. As someone who has beat cancer, I'm one of those people.
That's why I'm shocked Tony Evers and his allies say Scott Walker would end protections for people with pre-existing conditions. People like me. Our bipartisan plan helps people keep their coverage by lowering...
We had one listener, Peggy from Greendale, who asked, I'd like to know how Governor Walker can be claiming that he is addressing pre-existing conditions at the same time the state is in a lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. They are diametrically opposed. So what do we know about the truth or fiction of the candidate's claims about insurance coverage for pre-existing conditions?
Right. So that is an issue that's... there's been a lot of back and forth on that this week and last week. Governor Walker is saying that he wants to keep those pre-existing conditions protections. At the same time, he did approve a lawsuit that Attorney General Brad Schimmel decided to join that would repeal the ACA, which would remove those protections if that is successful. He did call for legislation last year that would somehow ensure those protections if there was, in the event that the lawsuit was successful. But as your listener points out, there are a lot of people, mostly on the Democratic side, who are saying that this doesn't make sense. Like, why would you support a lawsuit at the same time you want to keep something that's very popular in the ACA? He says that there are other parts of the ACA that he doesn't like, but that particular part is something that Wisconsin can ensure goes forward even without that law in place.
He's making the case that the federal government shouldn't be playing the role of requiring insurance companies, but the state government could.
Right.
Now, a follow-up question also from Stu in Delafield, who writes, and I'll quote again, "Despite PolitiFact debunking, neither side walks back their statements. Do they really believe voters are that stupid and don't see through the posturing and theatrics?" And our original question writer, Beatrice, asks, where are the muckrakers and watchdogs in this equation? They both speak to an issue here, which is that we could do all the debunking and fact-checking we can, but candidates aren't required to walk back anything they've said, and neither are the people who make the ads.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, candidates, as we can write, you know, 20 stories, PolitiFact. I mean, PolitiFact has done so many stories on just the Middleton teacher who was looking at pornography case. What the journalists do and how the candidates respond to that, you know, like we can't control how they respond to that. And there's nothing that enforces, you know, if we say, you know, here are the facts in this case and they conflict with what's in an ad, there's nothing that requires a candidate to acknowledge that.
I'm looking on my recording console here in the studio at an ad that the Republican Party of Wisconsin paid for, and it has a mock-up of a Journal Sentinel front page, which is obviously a recreation here. But as a political reporter, how do you feel when you see people in campaigns quoting your articles without necessarily giving the context?
Yeah, and that's where we come back in. You know, if we can't control that, if we see things like that, it's just like anything else. Like if we see, you know, potential voters absorbing information that we feel isn't complete or needs more context to understand what the facts of the case were, to make the best choice possible when they go into the voting booth, you know, that's what we have to do. And that's how we see all of that, you know, that it's, you know, we can't control what everybody else, how other people present the facts as we know them, but we can do that. We can control that. And luckily, I work for a paper that is very interested in doing that as much as possible.
Well, Molly Beck, thank you so much for helping us try to weed through some facts and fictions.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck covers politics from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel's State Capitol Bureau in Madison. You can learn how to participate in our Informed Voter Project at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then try to gain some insight on the relationship between Milwaukee's poverty rate and new statewide poverty numbers that just came out. That comes your way next on Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Hike. New Census Bureau estimates came out for both Wisconsin and the nation last week with numbers on 2017 poverty rates, median income levels, and health insurance coverage.
11.3% of Wisconsin's population is estimated to be below the poverty line. That's a full percentage point lower than the national average.
To get an understanding of what those numbers mean locally, WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with UWM Professor David Pate, who studies race and poverty.
He starts by describing the city of Milwaukee's poverty rate.
Milwaukee is currently, based on 2016 data, 28.4%. The data that's done for the city is slightly different based on it may be in two-year increments, but right now we're at 28.4%. So we're pretty much almost double what the national rate is. And for the state rate, we're almost, we're close to being a little, not a third, not three times the rate, but pretty close to being double, a little over the double, a little more than double.
And what do those numbers mean? I mean, it's a time of state economic expansion and low unemployment rates. What does that mean when we see these poverty rates in Milwaukee?
Well, it's interesting. Well, you know, for Milwaukee has been going through a lot of change since the 70s, the 80s, when a lot of manufacturing companies left. Therefore, we have not had the same possibilities for people to have access to jobs that would require only a high school degree. Therefore, those who may stop at high school and not go into college or get some college are now trying to get jobs that are slightly different than their parents may have gotten, and allow them and allow for Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular to be more of a middle class and thriving city.
Well, so when it seems like the economy is doing well, why are the poverty rates not really moving in Milwaukee?
Well, that's a very complex and complicated question to be answered in the short time that we have together, because of the fact that historically there has been some differences by race and gender for many people. By race, primarily a black labor force is dependent on the manufacturing companies. That was a major means of economic mobility. Those companies are no longer there. And for women who historically have always had a lower income threshold due to what jobs were available to women to be employed for, those jobs are not paying the wages that will allow families to move into a space of being upwardly mobile, because wages are generally more of poverty type wages. So we need to really look at how have wages changed over time, but also what companies are available that provide access to families to be able to take care of themselves in a way that they may have been doing in the past.
So to sum it up, the poverty rate in Wisconsin hasn't really changed much since the year before. Is that what you said?
That's correct. Poverty has been reduced. I mean, in terms of how we define poverty in our country based on solely cash income, more people are working in Wisconsin. We have what we would call a full employment in Wisconsin, if you look at it as a state. So we're doing extremely well if you look at Wisconsin as a state. It's when you start getting into the weeds and that you look at it by race and gender and location that you're going to see pockets of where people are extremely poor. But as a state, we're doing extremely well.
And what can the state do or do better to address the poverty in the categories that you're speaking of?
Well, you know, particularly for low-income black families, one of the biggest issues is, unfortunately, we have very high rates of mass incarceration. So, unfortunately, anyone with a criminal record oftentimes may be denied access to employment. So we need to figure out ways to allow employers to not hold that against people as a way of that not being as a way of holding back employment opportunities. We need to increase the minimum wage that we currently have in place, so that people are able to have a living wage and that they're able to take care of themselves. Also, that we need to address how do you handle when someone has a sickness or an illness in the family, so that when someone has to leave their job to take care of someone, that we enforce the Family Medical Leave Act, but also we attend to ways that people are able to leave their jobs in times of emergency, but not hold that be held against them that their jobs are not going to be gone. So there's a number of things that every state can do, because a lot of that is state policy. But again, it's a matter of the ideology of who is in control or who's in government at the time and wants to figure out ways to help families.
Do you know the numbers for race in terms of Wisconsin poverty numbers?
Well, you know, it depends on the neighborhood, and there's been some really good work done by some of my colleagues at UWM where they have looked at various pockets of the north side of Milwaukee where they have seen that the poverty rate can be as high as 65% for low-income, for African-American males. For example, where it can be as low, or it can be as low as, but being low is still not, it's still very high, being around 35%. So colleagues of mine who do more economic analysis are able to look at those numbers and make those kinds of estimates. But I know in my own work as a qualitative researcher, I often see a lot of despair and a lot of poverty in very poor communities, particularly in the north and south sides of Milwaukee.
How do the median income and health insurance coverage numbers look for Wisconsin in 2017?
Well, Wisconsin has always historically had a very good median income in terms of right now our median income is $59,300 according to the latest statistics. And neighboring states are even higher than Wisconsin, but Wisconsin has always been a really healthy state and always above whatever the median income has been nationally. Unfortunately for Milwaukee, the median income is much lower, particularly for blacks, it's like 40,000 which is historically been the number that you will see across the board for what this the income has been. And for whatever historical reasons there are for that, which has been lack of access to better jobs, lack of maybe poor education, not having a social network that will allow you to get a better job based on who you know and how you, and what skills you have to offer. Those are real issues that we have to figure out. How do you increase people's networks so they know whom to talk to about a job, how to get a job, how to maintain a job? And there's a number of people who are working on that as well and trying to reduce those inequities within the city, but also within the country.
Now, what would you say to politicians who say that the war on poverty is largely over and a success?
You know, the war on poverty, when it was instituted in the 60s under President Johnson, you can say in many ways it was successful. It raised income for the elderly. It provided access to health care for the elderly. It provided them with, which was better access to other services. So therefore, we can look historically at whom was able to profit and do better from the war on poverty. However, we have to also admit there is a significant group of people who are still very poor. And whether we judge them being poor by saying they're lazy or they're not productive, that's one way you could go. However, we do have a group, we do have people in this country who are working very, very hard. And even the most recent Time magazine article talks about people who have college degrees, and these statistics that came out last week even highlight this. The one group that has done the worst around the reduction of poverty and poverty has increased for is those with a bachelor's degree. So there's something going on about with our society and how we're providing access to those who we say is doing what we call the right thing. They still are having some challenges with being able to take care of themselves and not get into a space of being impoverished. So I do think that we have to figure out why is that going on and not just look at the numbers, but figure out, but answer the question why.
People with bachelor's degrees are having a hard time, are falling under the poverty line?
Mm-hmm. They were the one group that had the one of the highest numbers of poverty this year. I mean, I think it's important for people to know that when we look at the definition of poverty, we're looking at people's income before taxes. It doesn't include non-cash benefits or capital gains. We're simply looking at what does someone earn before taxes. The idea of the poverty line is also is for us to understand that when we look at someone who's impoverished in our country, we're saying a single adult who makes $12,752 without children, if they make 1 cent above that, they're not in poverty in our country. And it's time for us to reevaluate how we define poverty.
So what would your assessment be, your final assessment on the Wisconsin poverty rate in these past 2 years?
I mean, I think Wisconsin is a very healthy, great state to live in if you have access to the services that are available. By race, the picture is not as beautiful because there is some very stark and unfortunate poverty in the city of Milwaukee. That needs to be attended to, many of the families there need access to services that will allow them the dignity of being a citizen in America. Many of them are struggling with day-to-day existence. They don't have access to the same jobs that their counterparts do. Oftentimes in research that I have conducted with men in Milwaukee, when they would try to get a job outside of the city, they were often exposed to the phenomena of driving while black, being stopped repeatedly. Or the other problem is that there's not a really good transportation infrastructure for you to get to and from work if you don't have a car. So I think Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, some of those, you know, cities where we have a higher population of black and brown people, we need to figure out ways to provide access to them because their resources are limited. They don't have some of the same historical resources that their counterparts have in order for them to be able to maintain their family in the same way that they desire and wish to. So transportation needs to be increased, better access to housing, more training, and also more opportunities for those who have been returning from our correctional facilities in ways that will allow them to take care of their families as well.
Well, David Pate, thank you so much for speaking about this.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
David Pate is Associate Professor of Social Work at UW-Milwaukee's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver.
There will be more than 170 sites included in this year's Doors Open Milwaukee. After a break, we'll visit one that is so new it's not even finished yet. More in just a moment on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. More than 170 Milwaukee area buildings will open their doors to tourists this weekend.
Historic Milwaukee's annual Doors Open Milwaukee event also includes more than 30 tours of historic or otherwise notable places that the general public doesn't always have access to. One of those spaces this year will be a spot that people didn't always enjoy visiting.
The Five Points Art Gallery and Studios is in the process of occupying a building that was once a funeral home. The work in progress is on Port Washington Avenue in Milwaukee's Harambe neighborhood, and that's where I met up with a woman who had a vision for the space.
My name is Fatima Laster, and I'm an artist and I guess now a developer.
And this is your project?
This is my project. This is the Five Points Art Gallery and Studios, which is a mixed-use art space containing a gallery, artist studios, a commercial kitchen, and two residential apartments.
All right, but none of that is quite ready yet.
No, it's active under construction, but not active as far as the art production yet. But projecting like a completion of fall of this year. But yeah, if you come for Doors Open Milwaukee, you'll see a bustling construction site, but you'll still get to get the feel of the historical architecture that I'm trying to preserve, as well as kind of seeing the in progress and progress towards what it will be once it's completed.
All right. Well, before we go any further, who are you and what do you do?
I am Grace Spear. I'm the Special Events Director of Historic Milwaukee, and I manage Doors Open.
So let me ask you, why is this site, which is not yet done but is on its way to being done, why is this an important place to be part of Doors Open this year?
This is a great example of historic preservation in action, so I think it's a really great opportunity for the public to come and be educated on what that really looks like. We also this year are spotlighting King Drive sites and sites in the Harambe neighborhood and Bronzeville in general, so this is one of those sites, so it'll be really great for people to come here to the Five Points part of the very kind of northern part of King Drive, and then people will be able to see sites all along King Drive all the way basically to downtown. And a lot of really art-related sites too, so that's a really amazing thing about this neighborhood is the fostering of arts that's happening. So this is one really good example. Kindred building that used to be the Reader's Choice building is another really great example that's going to be home to Giselle's art studio. America's Black Holocaust Museum and the historic Garfield Apartments, which have murals on the interior. It's another really great example. The King Drive Art Commons is going to be open for Doors Open as well. So it's really showcasing a community of arts and in a lot of cases historic restoration as well.
Well, and as far as this building goes, Fatima, let me ask you, what's exciting about the idea of having people come through here and check it out even before it's finished?
The exciting part is introducing the visitors to my home neighborhood and just recycling of history. Like this facility is a historic, even though it's not a registered historic building, it is historic for this area and this neighborhood. And I'm excited about bringing vitality back to, I know it was a former funeral home, so it's like a play on words, but bringing the vitality and life back to it as it was closed for some time now. And just showing how recyclable buildings are and, you know, a community is too, and how to reinvest in the community. I am reinvesting in the community, and the idea for the project in general is to not only expose the arts to the community, but also to expose jobs related to the arts to the community too. So it's just about recycling the value in the community.
How did this happen to become your space? This was, as you say, a funeral home for a long time, and if I'm not mistaken, it's been vacant for a while. It was the city's property for a while.
Correct. So it's the former Johnson Goolsbee Funeral Home, and the city owned it for at least 2 years prior to me discovering it and inquiring about it. I was looking for a live workspace for myself for my art practice, and I drove past it and I saw it was boarded up, and then I did some inquiries with the city about it, and it turned out it was city owned, so that's who I purchased it from. And so that's how that started. I was looking for a space in this area to have a live work practice for the arts, and this is what came of it. It's larger than what I projected or what I was setting out to look for.
It's a pretty big building.
And it's a pretty big building, and it's even bigger on the inside than it looks on the outside. So when I actually got inside, I was like, okay, I have to make this sustainable. I don't need all of this for myself, so how can I make this more of a communal gathering spot, like an art mecca, like a Renaissance space?
Right, so what is your vision for the place?
The vision for the place is when you walk in on the main level, that will be the gallery floor. So that is the business entity within itself. And it'll have two gallery salons and a gift shop. And to the rear of the building, still on the main level, if you would consider it, will be a commercial kitchen for culinary artists and caterers who need a commercial kitchen to operate their own business out of. And then on the lower level or basement of the facility, there will now be 9 artist studios for working artists, primarily geared towards visual artists, but it's really open to any artist. And then to round off the project, it'll also have 2 residential apartments on the second level, each with 3 bedrooms and 1.5 baths. I added a half bath for each space to kind of keep up with the times and support the ratio of how many bodies might be in it. And so I will actually be residing in one of the units, and the other one will be for rent.
I can't imagine that work like this is inexpensive. Did you have to raise money to be able to fulfill this vision?
I'm still raising money to fulfill this vision. But yes, I got some financing through the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, and I also got assistance with the artist housing grant through the city and some other city grants as well.
Are there unique challenges in taking a space that was once a funeral home and turning it into, you know, gallery and living and kitchen space? I mean, considering what had to go on here for years?
It's probably less unique than one might think. Actually, the existing setup allowed for it to be what it is. It was already kind of compartmentalized into what I'm turning into art studios. When I saw it, I was like, huh, you know, these will make good art studios. And then the openness of the what would be the galleries, they were already open. And I'm like, okay, if I build some walls in here and utilize these beautiful walls, this is, you know, the salon for the galleries.
So are there architectural features that you wanted to make sure you kept?
Yes. A lot of plaster details that you cannot find either these days, or it's very, very expensive to replicate in plaster. So like the molding, and then there are like some decorative plaster windows that I'm trying to preserve. Even like the doors and like some of the leaded glass features I'm trying to keep. So a lot of the existing doors. Again, I really like blending historical with new. I do interior design as well, so that's my love. And you'll also see that in some of the residential, especially in my space. It'll be blending that historical and new element as well. So, yeah.
Well, and Grace, have there been active construction sites as part of Doors Open in the past?
We've had sites like the Majeska Theater in the past that have been part of it that were vacant buildings, but great examples of historic sites to see. So this, I think, is very unique and a really great opportunity for people to come and see the before, because we hope that they'll come back and visit once the doors are officially open, and then hope to feature the site again when it's a complete site in 2019. But as always with Doors Open, we hope that it's not just a weekend opportunity for people to dabble in sites, but that it gives them a taste and that they want to come back to the neighborhood and explore more.
Well, I wanted to make sure I asked, you were talking about the neighborhoods you're featuring, but what are some of the other new sites that are unique to this year's Doors Open?
So this year, for the first time, people will be able to go to the top of the Northwestern Mutual building. So that's the second tallest building in the state of Wisconsin. They'll get to go to the 32nd floor and see the sights of Milwaukee. We also have the Milwaukee Model Railroad Club, which is on National, just east of First Street. And that is a really interesting site because it's in what was historically a train station and is now one of the longest running model railroad clubs in the country. And then we also have a really unique site called Karma Lab. So they make actually and distribute Carmex. And that's a really unique spot because they have one of the largest pipe organs in the country that they're going to be playing throughout the weekend. So people will be able to come and check that out.
But I also see is the maintenance facility for the streetcar one of the spots?
It is, yes. Yeah. So people will be able to see that on Sunday, September 23rd, and see where the streetcars are stored. And also on the 22nd, one of the streetcars will actually be parked at our block party on Broadway in Michigan. So people will be able to tour that from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on the 22nd.
Fatima, we're standing in what was the garage now, and
which will
is
be
kind
the
of
commercial kitchen.
So okay, that was going to be my question. So there's a lot to be done in this space.
There is a lot to be done. It will move faster than you would think, but there is a lot to be done. The plumber is routing the plumbing in here, so that's why the ground is broken up. As you can see in that corner, that's where they're going to start roughing in for the water lines. But yeah, it's a lot to be done, but change occurs quickly, faster than you think. So even by the time Doors Open Milwaukee, there will be changes. They're constantly happening every day. And also for Doors Open Milwaukee, there are artists who are a part of the contracting team. So I'm planning on highlighting some of their works during Doors Open Milwaukee. And so I'm excited about that alongside with my works. So not only will visitors be able to tour the space, they'll also be able to look at discover artists who have other practices as well, and you know, be able to purchase their work if they like as a keepsake. And then again, the intent is for them to be excited about the space, but come back too as visitors to see the space, but also be patrons of the arts as well. So
has to be exciting and maybe make you just the slightest bit apprehensive about sort of opening this to the world for the first time before it's fully done. You don't sound apprehensive,
no,
actually.
It's like it is what it is. People walk in and out every day. I make it open, too. So I know there are people who pop in and out, and they get really excited. And a lot of passerbys, they love the sign that's up, too. So they're just really excited. So I let them get a preview. I mean, it's always exciting. People watch HGTV all the time, too. So they like the effect of the before and after. So, yeah, it's not a big deal.
Well, I hope we can come back for the after as well.
Yeah, you're more than welcome to, of course.
Outstanding. Well, thanks to both of you, and best of luck with this year's Doors Open.
Thank you very much. Thanks for including me.
Thank you for having us.
Grace Fuhr is Special Events Director for Historic Milwaukee and Manager of Doors Open. Fatima Laster is an artist and the developer of the new Five Points Art Gallery and Studios. The work in progress will be open to the public Saturday and Sunday as part of the annual Doors Open Milwaukee. You can see pictures of what to expect in the space at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then learn about an innovative dance and percussion collaboration on stage this weekend. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Percussion has always had a happy marriage with dancing. No matter the type of dance, social or artistic, we often find ourselves moving to the rhythm of the beat.
Two Milwaukee-based stalwarts in both dance and percussion are collaborating for a performance with the Milwaukee Ballet this Saturday. Aptly named Mueller and Springer, the event will feature music by composer John Mueller and choreography by Dawn Springer.
Springer starts by describing her current work as a performer and choreographer and how the two experimental artists mesh their unique talents in this singular collaboration.
So I trained as a classical ballet dancer. I went to North Carolina School of the Arts for high school and for college, where I trained across different dance disciplines, primarily ballet and very classical modern dance. I lived in New York for about on and off for about 10 years, working independently as a freelance artist and choreographer. Got tired of doing a lot of commuting up and down the East Coast for work, for teaching, for performing, and decided I wanted to create some artistic roots for myself and sort of find a personal home base. So I was home on a trip visiting family in Lake Geneva and happened to take a trip up to Milwaukee and just knew this was it. The city has enough going on, but offered enough space that I knew I could continue to do what I was doing, but be able to grow as an artist.
And John, how about you?
Well, the last time you and I talked, Bonnie, was for the Deaf Blues event at El Verno Presents. And that project involved dance. There was a dancer, Molly Shanahan, involved in that. And since then, you know, through that project, I guess I became interested in working more with dance and different dancers and seeing what all the possibilities were. And so when I eventually met Dawn, you know, we started talking right away about a potential project, and that sort of formed into a pretty involved piece that we premiered at the Eau Claire Festival, at the first Eau Claire Festival as well. And, you know, this will be our fourth time working together since. And you know, I think what's great about working with Dawn is that we have talked enough about the individual projects, but also, you know, outside of that, I think we both really sort of understand each other's work in a very similar way. It's gotten to the point now with me where I don't think so much about dance as this external or separate thing, but that movement and sound really are sort of part of the same world, and they can function very naturally together. It doesn't necessarily have to be viewed as someone reacting to sound through movement. It sort of all is movement together, and I think Dawn and I share similar ideas about that, and we both have similar goals in working toward reaching that point. And so it's a really natural collaboration with her.
And so, Dawn, had you heard John perform before you decided that you wanted to make an artistic connection?
Yes, actually. I saw him perform with Volcano Choir at the Pabst. And interestingly enough, it was right after I moved back to Milwaukee. I hadn't been in the Pabst since I was there to see the Nutcracker probably when I was 12. So, you know, my own artistic work had taken a sort of radical detour from those roots. But I remember the thing I remember most vividly about that show was John's performance within it, particularly a moment in which he was playing primarily by himself. And I was absolutely struck by how virtuosic he was as a performer and how he, with his body and with his instruments, was able to contain a sort of energy that felt just very powerful. My own work is very much grounded in finding ways for women within dance and now classically trained ballet dancers who are women, finding ways for them to visibilize power and effort within their own movement. So as John is saying, it was a very natural collaboration when we started because there was a sort of mutual understanding that we were interested in making the blood, sweat, and tears of the work visible. And that is what the choreography is very centered around, is sort of utilizing and destroying the archetype of perfection within the female dancer. And John's music and sound also offers this sort of rhythmic structure that I don't necessarily attach to. So we each have our own sort of rhythmic structures that are working alongside one another. But in so doing, there's a combination of both of those efforts happening at the same time that for me is where the strength of the work and the collaboration really exists. Neither one is following the other, but they truly are coexisting in time and space together.
Right, the archetypal two sides of the same coin kind of thing all happening. And John, I have to say, you know, having seen you perform a couple of times, the idea that we shouldn't see how much work something is seems to be an ideal. And and I love the fact that when I have seen you perform, I see just how much work you're doing, and it doesn't take anything away from the artistry.
Yeah, for me, and John, you can speak to this more, but for me, it's you can't, as a percussionist, it seems very clear. We really see exactly the physicality that's required of the musician.
Yep.
I guess I don't ever really consciously think about making something look easy, because it's not, you know, I know that there's value in that, but that's not really an aim for me. An aim for me is really to sort of bring out this visible or physical energy, a sense of energy being transmitted. So, you know, that's not to say that if it looks, you know, like it's this intense struggle, that there's this kind of energy gain from that physicality. I think it's more about creating a situation where, you know, people get absorbed enough by the sound that they forget that there's people actually involved in it, and that they just become completely consumed by what's happening with the sound and with their own interaction with that. And I think in getting to that point, you have to definitely put in a substantial amount of physical energy to create that. You just don't want the act of doing that to distract from the experience of getting to just focus on the sound.
You know, Dawn, I was thinking when you were saying about the idea of allowing classically trained female dancers to show their power and to show the work that goes into what they do. One of the things that has always bothered me about dance in general, and that's whether it's classical, it's ballet, whether it's modern dance, Broadway, all of it, only recently have we been allowed to see women do the athletic and physical things that men have always done. Men seem to have had more opportunity to be softer in their movement than women to be powerful. And I don't know if that's true, but that's been my impression. It seems like that's changing.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think that there's a lot about the dance field that's changing. I agree in the sense that what I've seen a lot is that dance often has a lot of large, sweeping phrases that tend to be performed by men. And of course, you know, those are generalizations. But I'm very drawn to the moments in which I get to see women on stage on their own terms, not in choreography where they're being partnered by a man, or in choreography where we're getting to see them feel their own strength and to just really be allowed to move. Now, the work that I'm doing currently, the dancers are wearing pointe shoes, so that adds this very, very constrained element to their movement, for sure. And I'm interested in how they are pushing against that within the choreography, and then sort of accepting that in other moments in their choreography. So it's a little bit of a play on working within that constraint and pushing through it. It's a comment on it, and also a way of finding something else.
Well, there's certainly a lot of strength, as you well know, to go on point.
Yes.
It takes a huge amount of strength to do that.
Yeah, I haven't worn pointe shoes since I was, it's been about 20 years. So in the rehearsal process, I was constantly having to ask the dancers, showing them something and then asking them, is this actually possible? So each of the dancers was really encouraged to make the movement work for themselves. I told them very clearly that they don't have to look like each other. So the movement does have, the choreography is a, you know, predetermined set of steps and a set of vocabulary that they're working from, but each of them really has made the movement and translated that movement into their own bodies in a way that felt organic and personal to them.
I think that everyone, when you say ballet to people, everyone knows what that means. They have a picture in their head about what that's like and what it looks like. But when you're right in front of these people, dancing with these shoes on, and seeing the movements that they do, the reality of the difficulty of it and the physical strength of it is really apparent. It's just something that struck me in the last performance that we did. I mean, it's visually powerful to see. And so I think that even just visually, that outside of the movement, just the reality of what's happening, it enforces that sense of energy that I was talking about before.
Has watching the dancers doing what you've described and kind of seeing, you know, the power and everything in that, has it changed the way you approach making music?
No, I think it definitely adds a sense of energy to my and Dave's playing. Dave Utzinger is the pianist in this piece. So Dave and I had been rehearsing independently on just the music for a couple of months. And, you know, we were comfortable with the performance and what we needed to do. But once we got in the room with the dancers and had that additional activity around us, it really sort of, you know, it adds this whole other dynamic to how you're playing your instrument. And I think it, you know, in the moments when it was just Dave and I, there were parts where it, you know, would be easy to get tired or, you know, cut the duration of certain parts shorter just because it seemed unnecessary. But when you have this movement happening in front of you, it sort of keeps your energy at this consistent level that is really great, because it's difficult in some cases to keep going.
So this is number four that you've worked on together. Do you see this partnership continuing artistically? It sounds like you keep coming up with new ways of working with each other.
Mm. Well, when we were sitting, we performed this piece in Door County a couple weeks ago, and when we were sitting at dinner the night before, John was telling me about an idea he's had for a couple years. And my immediate response was, yes, we have to do that. Yes, I know exactly what I would want to do with the container of that idea. So, you know, as long as we're spending time together, I think we're going to continue to think of things to do.
Yeah, I was going to say there's always more ideas. And like I was saying initially, I mean, I think Dawn and I have an understanding at this point that's strong enough to just, I mean, the ideas are the thing. You have to come up with an idea, and then you start working on that. And as long as either of us have ideas, I don't see any issue.
Where and when and all of that for this one?
So the performance is at Studio 8 at Meltwater Studios in Bayview. It's 1911 South Alice Street. And you can get tickets at brownpapertickets.com by searching for Springer Mueller.
The full title is just Springer Mueller?
That's correct.
Okay.
The performance space is a very intimate performance space, which is intentional for us to really be able to see what's happening in a very close proximity. So there is very limited seating, so advanced reservations are strongly recommended.
And it's just that one day, right?
Yep. Two performances on September 22nd, 7 and 9 p.m.
All right. Well, I can't thank you both enough for joining me today. John and Dawn, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Dawn Springer is a Milwaukee-based performer and choreographer. John Mueller is a Milwaukee musician and composer. They spoke with Bonnie North. The two collaborated for a performance this Saturday featuring artists from the Milwaukee Ballet, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening. Fresh Air is next.